Thanks for coming along tonight, where both Chris Mitchell and Chris Kenny make welcome returns to the Sydney Institute. They're well known to all of you here tonight, so I'll be very brief. We're going to, as you know, the topic is the media and freedom of speech, two views, and we thought both Chris's had interesting but somewhat different views on this topic. So we're going to start off with Chris Mitchell, a columnist with The Australian, former editor-in-chief of The Australian, and of course a published author. And Chris Kenny, also a published author, a columnist with The Australian, a presenter on Sky News, and I think your position at The Australian is associate editor, is that right? There we are, got it all right. So we'll start off with Chris Mitchell, and then we'll go straight to Chris Kenny, then we'll go to questions and discussion. Chris Mitchell, you're very welcome, thank you.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for coming on a blustery winter's night. Thanks very much to Jared and Ann for inviting Chris Kenny and me to discuss the media and freedom of speech. I wrote a column for The Oz about this issue on June 17, aware, as I wrote from reading blog comments on stories on the issue, that many readers don't share journalists' sympathies for free speech. They sided with the Australian Federal Police after raids on News Corp reporter Annika Smithurst and the ABC in the first week of June. My intro for that piece read, "While journalists obsess about media raids by Australian Federal Police a fortnight ago, much of the public is sceptical, trusting the security services far more than they do the Fourth Estate in the era of fake news and activist reporting." I tried to allow in the column for what ASIO and Defence Department former Chief Dennis Richardson, a close contact during my days as editor-in-chief of the paper, had said that week about terror-related laws enacted since the September 11, 2001 World Trade Center attacks. These laws, Dennis said, had protected Australians by helping to foil several domestic mass casualty attacks in the 17 years since S11. I tried to show in my piece that freedom to report and freedom from terror are not mutually exclusive. Yet many of the 250-odd commenters on the column were sceptical about the idea that whistleblowers or journalists could be trusted to act in good faith on national security. In 46 years in the business, nearly 25 of them as a daily newspaper editor, I've learned Australians don't really share the views of American founding father Thomas Jefferson, who said he would rather have newspapers without a country than a country without newspapers. Like the wider question of free speech generally and the push for defamation law reform, Australians remain ambivalent to a free exchange of ideas. In an era when people can make wild, unsubstantiated allegations on social media with little fear of legal comeback, there is little trust in professional journalists who must get over very high legal bars before publication in the mainstream media. Maybe this is because Australian society, after a century of state paternalism post-federation, really does believe the old adage, it's impolite to talk about politics, religion and sex in company. The only good subjects to talk about, I'd say. Yet many Australians, happy to talk endlessly about sport, distrust the sort of rambunctious free speech my old editor Frank Devine admired about US society. Here we have, until the summary execution of Kevin Rudd in 2010, and the succession of prime ministers since, tended to be largely trusting of our politicians, and of our police for that matter. Yet having lived day to day with regular, sometimes forceful and often quite threatening contact from these leaders in both politics and law enforcement, I would trust most journalists I've met more than many politicians and lots of senior police. An example. My successor at The Australian, the newish CEO of Sky News, Paul Whittaker, was raided by the AFP at his Gold Coast apartment before dawn in late 1995 over a story that eventually won him a Walkley Award for revealing the activities of former Labor Senator Graham Richardson in what would become known as the Operation Waller Affair. The raid that tipped Whittaker and his wife out of bed before dawn was led by Northern Division Commander of the AFP, Mick Kelty, by 2001 Commander of the National Force. Later that day, Mick and a team of investigators raided Queensland newspapers in my office. They searched the 11-hectare QN site inside and out in a vain hunt for evidence for the source of leaks that identified Richo's involvement with Gold Coast crime figure Nick Carlos, Carlos's prostitutes, and a meeting with a group of businessmen who were trying to sell stolen MX missile guidance systems to the Chinese. It's all in federal Hansard if you don't believe it, but unfortunately it wasn't really reported in the South. It was a tough day for Mick as he sat in my office drinking coffee and talking to head office in Canberra while his police searched. Lucky he didn't know how close he was to the material he was looking for. The AFP was trying to shut down Paul Whitaker's reporting on a plot that was really a threat to national security rather than investigate that plot itself. It was motivated not by preventing wrongdoing but by politics. The police left embarrassed, braving TV and newspaper cameras on the way into QN and again on the way out. Whitaker had phoned me before breakfast to advise that the police were on their way from the Gold Coast. I advised the local television and radio stations that they'd be at the Queensland newspapers shortly. That night, after page one, I was sitting there about 10 o'clock. My phone rang and it was a very, very senior federal government minister. He made quite serious threats to me personally and to Whitaker, and these were all threats on behalf of the Labor Party rather than in the national interest. The raids sort of taught me that the public interest really isn't the same as the interest of private politicians. I used a more recent example in my June 17 column, again involving the AFP, raiding journalists in a story that was, I thought, was clearly in the public interest, but damaging politically. Martin Chuloff, then the Australian's terrorism editor, in 2005 broke a series of stories about internal reports into the operations of the Australian Customs Service, now part of Australian Border Force, within Home Affairs Minister Peter Dutton's portfolio. The internal customs reports were prepared by Alan Kessing, whose home was raided after our publications. The paper never named its source. Kessing was convicted despite maintaining his innocence. While I suspect a political motive for the action against the paper and why suspect a political motive for the action against the paper and Kessing? Well, the responsible aviation minister was then Deputy PM John Anderson, who took up the recommendations of Kessing's report and spent $220 million bolstering customs defences against drug trafficking and terrorism. Anderson's swift action showed the paper was right to reveal reports that had been sat on by bureaucrats for 3 years. The raids were merely bureaucratic arse covering at a time when airport security was one of the biggest issues worldwide politically. After last June's raids, the AFP assured the public there was no political motive for the search of Annika Smithers' Canberra house on June 4 or the ABC the following day. The timing of two raids on separate investigations was apparently driven only by the progress of police inquiries and had nothing to do with the federal election a fortnight earlier. Smethurst, in April 2018, in the Sunday Telegraph, had published a story revealing Peter Dutton's department was considering a plan to allow the Australian Signals Directorate, which tracks overseas electronic transmissions, to target the communications of ordinary Australians. The ABC raids concerned a material leaked for a story, The Afghan Files, first published on 7:30 on July 10, 2017, so a year earlier. The stories were not connected. They didn't present any threat to national security, and they were in the public interest. Raid timing was purely coincidental, apparently. Perhaps the raid was really to intimidate whistleblowers, leakers and reporters. How odd, too, that this coincidence of timing on stories published a year apart extended to an AFP phone call on Monday, June 3, to 2GB host Ben Fordham, warning Ben was being investigated about a story he ran during the campaign concerning people smuggling attempts during the lead-up to the election. In the wake of Parliament's passing late last year of Karen Phelps' Medivac bill, and warnings a change of government would restart, or could restart, the flow of asylum seeker boats to Australia, there was a clear public interest in Fordham telling his listeners the boats had indeed started. Minister Dutton must have thought so too, because the same week he travelled to Sri Lanka to discuss people smuggling with the government there, and on June 20 he confirmed in a page one interview with the Australian Simon Benson that one boat from Sri Lanka had indeed been intercepted. So, Even if the timing was not coincidental, how seriously should we take this so-called threat to a free press? In my view, the media's case has not been helped by overheated rhetoric suggesting Australia is on a path to totalitarianism because of two raids on journalists, even if they're on successive days. My offices at the Courier Mail and the Australian were raided three times by the AFP. I did not fear totalitarianism. The Australian vigorously supported the Howard government's terror laws designed to increase police powers to take preventive action to interrupt terror plots before they occur. My journalists Martin Chuloff and Colleen Egan made contacts with terror players and put those players in touch with federal police. Ibrahim Fraser in Sydney and Perth Muslim convert Jihad Jack Roach, who planned and was convicted of trying to blow up the Israeli embassy, were both unknown to police until journalists put them in contact with the AFP. The Oz also editorialised in favour of legal action to restrict the flow of information and images over the internet on overseas terrorist cells and child pornography, rejecting internet activists' arguments that freedom online is paramount. Nor do I believe tracking journalists' travel plans and metadata, as revealed by the Sydney Morning Herald this week, is a dramatic threat to journalism. Young reporters don't realise that in the days before the internet, authorities had the power to obtain a secret warrant from a judge to track reporters' call charge records. Without tapping phones, the authorities could find out through Telstra and Optus exactly who a reporter had phoned. This is why my investigative reporters usually used a range of different prepaid mobile phones working on a single story. Today, reporters need to be more careful about their electronic footprints, as we were 20 years ago. Nor do I buy the idea that conservative governments, such as those of Howard and former Prime Minister Tony Abbott, represent a particular threat to the media. In the US, journalists have focused on President Trump's attacks on fake news media. Perhaps if the progressive news organisations he criticises had campaigned harder against the press crackdown of President Obama, they might have had more credibility now. Between 1917 and 2009, only one government whistleblower was convicted in the US. Under Obama, eight were. Nor do I believe in source protection as an absolute. In my book, Making Headlines, and in several columns over the past 3 years, I have argued there is a difference between protecting a whistleblower who provides genuine information of national importance and being used by anonymous political sources to produce stories that damage that source's political opponents or improve the career prospects of that source. If journalists were more careful to not to let themselves be used by political sources, there would, I am certain, be more public support now for the protection of genuine confidential sources. Here I'm referring to the sort of leaks used by former Prime Minister Kevin Rudd to damage opponents on his way towards the leadership of his party and to hurt rivals after he had lost the leadership to Julia Gillard. The media would lose little and gain much in credibility if it forced leakers to go on the record. The body politic would also be better off appearing more transparent to voters. Yet I am still certain that the whistleblowers in the Waller and Kessing cases deserved protection rather than a police and legal witch hunt. I am certain the corporate whistleblowers who have contacted Adele Ferguson after failing to get action through the legal processes of the Whistleblower Protection Act deserve better. Commonwealth Bank whistleblower Jeff Morris, ATO whistleblower Richard Boyle, former Commonwealth Chief Medical Officer Dr. Ben Coe have been hounded for doing the right thing. The Hayne Royal Commission makes this absolutely clear. It is not just whistleblowers. The failure of the Coalition to reform Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act, the persecution of Bill Leake, and the denigration of rugby union player Israel Folau for simply stating beliefs most Christians have held for 2,000 years and most Polynesian footballers share still today suggests to me something's wrong in the national discourse. At a time when the prevailing left-wing sentiment of Twitter and Facebook is being used like a McCarthyist weapon to silence free speech, the mainstream media should get more support for its traditional role in exposing the secrets of the great and powerful. After all, lawyers enjoy professional privilege. Politicians have privilege in the House. Yet both groups are sceptical of media claims for professional privilege. I would venture more lawyers and politicians have been jailed in the past decade than journalists. and with several key defamation actions with severe financial penalties for publishers facing challenging business conditions, most notably the recent Jeffrey Rush case, I believe there is a strong case for the Right to Know campaign being led by News Corp CEO Michael Miller, Nine CEO Hugh Marks, and the ABC's MD David Anderson. After their appearance at the National Press Club in Canberra on June 26, Miller summarised what the media wants in 4 points. One, the warrants regime for searching journalists' properties, records and workplaces needs reform. An independent arbitrator, such as a judge, should weigh the balance between the requirements of an investigation and the need for a free flow of information. The sweeping warrants for last June's raids were signed by a magistrate in Queanbeyan with no notice given to the media groups involved first. Two, whistleblower protection, said Miller. More and more we are seeing the government and ASIC wanting the private sector to protect whistleblowers. The same processes to protect them need to be in place for those working in the public sector. Three, the number of areas in government in which material is marked secret and top secret. Miller's speech quoted from former National Security Monitor Brett Walker SC in recommending reform in this area. And I think once upon a time they used to just take documents across the cabinet table to get cabinet privilege, but now they just stamp things, whether they're national security important or not. Their fourth point was journalists need to be exempted from laws that could jail them for simply doing their jobs. So in my view, national security services, police, politicians, courts and the public service work for taxpayers and voters. They're our servants. They should be accountable to taxpayers and voters through the media and at the ballot box. Within the necessary constraints of genuine national security concerns, the bias should be in favour of transparency. As I concluded on June 17, evidence overseas shows it doesn't have to be the way it is here now. Popular culture has made heroes of whistleblowers in the US. Think of Hollywood blockbusters like Serpico, Silkwood, Aaron Brockovich. Think of the role of whistleblowing in the Watergate break-in. American laws even operate an award system that allows whistleblowers to earn as much as 30% of the penalties imposed in legal action against companies defrauding governments. Whatever your views about journalists, people should think very carefully before they decide a free press, free speech, the freedom to offend, and religious freedom are not in the public interest. Thank you.
Many thanks, Chris Mitchell. Chris Kenny.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Chris Mitchell, and thanks to Jared and Anne, Jacqueline, for being having me along here. It's always a pleasure to speak at the Sydney Institute. It's a fantastic job you do. Spreading ideas, contesting ideas. Now, there were times early in my life as a political staffer when a not yet extinguished journalistic flame burned with imagination. As Chief of Staff to the South Australian Premier, I would flip through my state cabinet folder and fantasise about how many of the submissions could be turned into front page newspaper stories or lead items on the television news. Then later, as Chief of Staff to the Foreign Minister, I couldn't help but ponder how the inside word on briefings in Federal Cabinet's National Security Committee might make a media splash. It was never a temptation, believe me, but it was often a passing thought. The media freedom debate is often an adversarial argument between the media, the spillers of secrets, and the politicians and bureaucrats and officials who are the keepers of secrets. My perspective is relatively unique, having been at various times in both camps. After a career in journalism, I ventured into political staffing and worked at senior levels over a decade before returning back to the media, mainly as a commentator. Information is the currency of journalism, and when you reach a certain level in political staffing, you find yourself surrounded by riches. Conversely, many in politics who crave media adulation, and they sometimes figure that the best way to get that is to leak to journalists. Journalism, I think, represents the best and worst of our curiosity. Reporters want to know, they want to find out, and they want to be the first to tell others. This can be a high-minded pursuit to reveal truth and right wrongs, and it can be a grubby business of prying and spreading malicious gossip. The predisposition of journalism to reveal facts and spread the disinfectant of sunlight is a useful force in society, but one that surely must not be unfettered. some sort of tension must exist between the rights, the media's right to know, and the propensity for government to commercial, political, and personal confidentiality. That tension, I think, must exist to some degrees. As in most things, though, the argument is really about the appropriate balance. So this is subjective, and it can change as our government, security, and media environment changes. And in the digital era, when everything is changing, even the rapidity at which change occurs, it's no real surprise that these tensions are being strained again. Most, of course, in the media have never borne the heavy responsibility of holding official or commercial secrets. And many in governments, politics, and business have never experienced the altruistic curiosity that can drive many journalists. Having experienced both mindsets, I view the latest debate about media freedom with some ambivalence. Don't get me wrong, media freedom is vital and it must be preserved, and I think the media companies are doing the right thing, supporting their journalists and pushing for reform. Some of the useful ideas that are being advanced, we just heard from Chris, such as subjecting police searches of journalistic files to judicial review before they're carried out. And I think the over-classification of material ought to be tackled too, with even experienced defence and security hands such as former Senator and former Major General Jim Molan and former ASIO Defence and Foreign Affairs Chief Dennis Richardson have both agreed that this is a factor, that over-classification is an issue. So I think we need to ensure that this is not a debate about absolutes, and that recent events on the journalism side of the equation, as well as on the government side, have a bearing on it. Being a reporter can be like a sickness. The relentless competition and the endless skipping from one episode to the next cultivates a sense of dismissiveness. Human tragedies and historic events are referred to merely as yarns, in a way that creates a sort of protective distance between reality and the professional observer. Journalists can be blinded to a lot of other considerations by the lure of the yarn. A reporter's instinct is to share, to blab. But when journalists make the switch to a political staffing business or a bureaucratic role, their sensibility should change, of course. By the time I was Chief of Staff to the Foreign Minister and attending NSC meetings, my mindset was focused on the complex issues and how to manage them. Media management, public announcements, and communication strategies were then just one of many angles to consider. And confidentiality under the law, of course, was a given. Top secret security clearance can give you access to a realm of secretive and sensitive information, fascinating dilemmas, and enlightening intelligence, but it comes with a heavy burden of responsibility, enforceable by law. The security clearance process itself underlines the privilege bestowed upon you and the trust that goes with it. The Crimes Act, of course, wields the ultimate sanctions, but a sense of duty to your country and to the people who serve it, I think, tends to be the overriding motivator for people in that situation. It certainly was for me. And there are well-honed practices that control the distribution and safekeeping of top secret and other classified material, and it means you're constantly reminded of the value placed on confidentiality. This can sometimes be a pretty sobering process. Just a couple of examples that stand out in my mind was on trips to Baghdad soon after the fall of Saddam Hussein, to Kabul at the height of the Afghanistan war, and to Jakarta after the 2004 embassy bombing. I recall security briefings so sensitive that all the documents were ripped out of our hands as soon as we'd read them. In many countries, we were advised to be careful with conversations in our hotels and, of course, on our phones. Meetings were sometimes held in special safe rooms in embassies, protected from electronic surveillance. But once in a mysterious Middle Eastern country, I recall a small group of us, including the minister and a couple of intelligence agents, cranking up the stereo in the hotel room to about 11 and talking into each other's ears in the middle of the room. Secrets are only as safe as the people holding them, and there have been embarrassing tales of misplaced documents. In 1997, a 93-page dossier containing Australian briefings about Pacific Island nations and their leaders was left on the table outside a Cairns meeting. It included all sorts of dirt, informed by intelligence about corruption and other activities. Some of this spy stuff over the years I found quite amusing. Once I was told an unknown ASIS agent would meet me in an airport lounge to pass on some safe hand intelligence that can only be handed from person to person. And when I walked into the lounge, it was filled with 100 blokes in suits. But one of them stood out to me. He was sitting there busy reading a newspaper, and no, he didn't have peepholes cut out in the middle of it. But for some reason, he looked like an agent to me. So I walked up to him and asked if he was looking for me. Bingo. Either he was a bad spy, or I have good spider. Once in Dubai, I'd arranged to share an early morning lift to the airport with the chief of one of our security agencies. We wasted quite a bit of time at reception, faffing around trying to chase this misplaced car booking he'd made before he remembered that he booked it under a pseudonym. Security breaches, whether accidental or by design, strategic or malicious, I think encapsulate human strengths and frailties and are part of the rich media, political and diplomatic dynamic. We're seeing this unfold, of course, in real time now with the leaking to the media of British cables from Washington providing strident criticism of President Trump and his administration. It should be no surprise to anyone that the Foreign Office is now being investigated to try and track down the source of that damaging leak. Much of the time, of course, this is a deadly serious business. My time in foreign affairs covered the Iraq War, the Bali bombings, the search for WMD, the controversy over the Australian Wheat Board, the emerging threat at home and abroad from Islamist extremist terrorism, international efforts to constrain North Korea, and a range of other sensitive and ongoing challenges. I think when I was thinking about this talk, I thought it's instructive to think back over that period and consider how much of what I learned then through highly classified sources eventually ended up in the public domain. In my experience, most of it does become public eventually. To a large degree, government confidentiality is about timing, an effort to control information while decisions are being made or responses are being prepared. Once those decisions are made, our responses and the responses happen, much of the information underpinning them is shared with the public. I just want to share with you an example of how the media and confidentiality and these tensions can play out. It must have been in late 2002 or early 2003, in the months before the invasion of Iraq, when the focus was on compliance with UN resolutions and who might join the US if there was military action. As media advisor then to Alexander Downer, I took a call from Laurie Oakes, who claimed to have a leaked diplomatic cable that proved, contrary to the government's assertions, that Australia had already decided to join military action. Oakes provided just enough information that we were able to track down what we thought was the cable in question. It related to the rotation of our naval vessels, which had been helping to impose UN sanctions against Iraq for more than a decade since the first Gulf War. So when I explained to Oakes how this context changed everything, it related to an ongoing operation of our naval vessels, not new deployments, the discussion became pretty heated. It always stuck in my mind, this discussion, because, well, one, it was Laurie Oakes, I suppose, but on the other side, John Howard happened to be in our office to come up and talk about all this, and he heard my end of this animated exchange and was sort of urging me on. Channel 9 ran the story, creating misconceptions about the process. And this, to me, was a classic case of how the isolated leaking of specific documents or sections of them can be misleading without the context available to those involved. Agree or disagree with the decision, if you like, about the Iraq War, but I think Howard's consideration of this military action, from everything I saw, of course, it was always highly likely Australia would play a role, but his consideration was careful, methodical and honest. Still, aside from that sort of smear in the political world of dishonesty, Oakes's leak might have added to the public debate. In a roundabout way, it highlighted the dilemma of the existing naval deployment. Would we really spend a decade helping to enforce a sanctions blockade on Iraq, and then when hostilities broke out, to enforce those same sanctions, order our ships home? This is the to and fro of the secrets game. Should the diplomat or defence officer who leaked that cable be traced, tracked down and prosecuted? Was there a public interest served? Was that person a misguided whistleblower, a malicious schemer, or someone trying to curry favour with a journalist? Oakes might have a fair idea, because he knows where the leak came from. The rest of us are guessing. But it is a mistake, in my view, to think that all leaks are worthy, altruistic, or harmless. The mass leaks we've seen in the modern era of WikiLeaks, Assange, Snowden, Manning, are deeply worrying. We know they exposed sources, possibly cost lives, and certainly endangered operations. This recklessness, dressed up as journalism, makes it harder for responsible journalism to win the argument for greater freedom. For leaks to serve the public interest, they must surely do more than expose secrets for exposure's sake. This, in my view, is where the media must, and to be fair, usually does, show care and responsibility. The dilemma is that the media is now so fragmented that the usual checks and balances from editorial leadership in responsible mainstream media often doesn't apply. Is Assange a journalist? The Australian Journalists Union certainly thinks so. They gave him and WikiLeaks a Walkley Award. What about Snowden and Manning? One journalist whistleblower is another person's traitor. And who gets to draw that fine line? The starting point in the discussion must be that for governments to function properly and national security to be preserved, there must be confidentiality and there must be an obligation on people to respect it. There must be occasions when leaks are investigated and, logically, leakers prosecuted. The alternative to that is anarchy, a situation where the media holds out the temptation of revenge or glory, and there's no disincentive to take advantage of that offering. Now, as Chris has outlined, there are many, many legitimate whistleblowers. Deep Throat calling out to Richard Nixon's criminal conspiracies, or Jeff Morris, as Chris referred to as well, revealing the disturbing practices at the Commonwealth Bank. There'll always be people inside government, business, defence and intelligence agencies or political officers who harbour a grudge, partisan objectives, malicious intent, or suffer from delusions of grandeur. Think of Godwin Gretsch. Now, I was Malcolm Turnbull's chief of staff during that debacle, so it pains me even to mention the name. But although I must say I never met Gretsch or had any contact or communication with him, we know from the public record that over a period he leaked highly sensitive material from within Treasury to the opposition. He did this when the Rudd Labor government was trying to tackle the global financial crisis. Apparently these leaks were accurate, but think about the treachery involved, along with the illegality and the possible consequences. Later, as we all now know, simply because of some Walter Mitty-style fantasy to bring down the government, who knows, Gretsch created a fake email and he leaked that too. Now, we all saw the political drama that unfolded from that and we can discuss that another time, but my point here is what Gretsch did. Was he a traitor, a plotter, a fraudster, a criminal, a fool, or a whistleblower? Or was he all of that and more? And how has he been able to frame himself in the media as a victim? There must be rules around confidentiality, and there must be consequences for breaking them. And to be frank, if that occasionally means a journalist's office is searched, I don't think that's too high a price to pay. Not that police should be able to find anything. Any journalist worth their salt dealing in serious leaks would be ordinarily aware of two things: that the leak might be investigated, and that they need to make sure they leave no trail that will identify their leaker. Although I do agree with Chris's point that in this age, removing that electronic footprint is more and more complicated. So this is not necessarily an endorsement from me of these recent episodes. These seem to be farcical to me in the case of the ABC, and over the top when it came to Annika Smethurst's home. The idea of subjecting to such searches, though, to a judicial process before warrants are issued is worth considering, but it would demand weighing the public interest. As it stands, there's no public interest defence under the Crimes Act, although it can be argued as a factor in sentencing. A legislated public interest test might be a wise protection, but codifying it won't be easy. maybe, just maybe, there's an attraction for government, because as long as the test can be reasonably defined, it might be better than the current situation where really the public interest is effectively defined in practice by journalists and whoever leaks to them. For its part, the media needs to be more consistent. Too many, especially in the leftist media, pick and choose their media freedoms. Journalists who supported the Gillard Labor government's attempt at de facto regulation of the print media have weakened their arm, surely, in the current debate. So have the journalists who cheered for the sanctioning of Andrew Bolt under Section 18C of the Racial Discrimination Act. Now they pretend to be warriors for media freedom. Many of these same journalists stood by while the Queensland University students and the late great Bill Leake were pursued under the same laws. And they cheer the sacking of Israel Folau. Media freedom means freedom of expression for all, not picking and choosing according to fashion or perceived ideology. It's not just governments and police who can have a stifling effect on free expression. How many journalists now demanding transparency willfully accepted the blind decision-making over the Hindmarsh Island Bridge, based on, as it was, on the Hindmarsh Island secret women's business that we now know was fabricated? That's a timely question, isn't it, encapsulating religious freedom, cultural privilege, and government secrecy. Yes, there should be more media freedom. There should be greater media freedom. Now is a good time to have this debate and look at reform. But that means more than revealing government secrets. It also means understanding responsibilities and context and freeing up mindsets within the media. Thank you.
Many thanks to Chris Mitchell and Chris Kenny for enlightening positions on the topic of the media and freedom. So we get both of you up here. Chris, you come this side. Chris, you go the other side. Yes, that's fine.
Are you?
I got to stay here. And so thanks for keeping to your time. So we got to the top of the hour. What's the role of the police in this? I mean, as you know, at the moment there are requests that the government should go to the Australian Federal Police and tell it what to do, but that can't be done, can it?
Well, look, I think implied in my talk is I think it does get done. I mean, I do think Attorneys General, both in state and federal politics, do have a pretty close relationship with senior police, and I think that's why police commissioners often change when governments change. My own experience with the AFP is that certainly in the Labor time, both the Attorney General and the Minister for Justice were very closely involved with all the raids that I was involved with.
Yeah, I tend to agree. You don't need to be too conspiratorial about this. Police commissioners, there is a separation of powers, but they don't operate in a vacuum. And if the government sort of lets them know that they think this stuff is counterproductive, not necessarily for the government, but maybe for the police or for the wider public good, then I think they can be urged to drop some of these investigations. Although the other point here is the timing of these latest two raids. I think there's a great likelihood here, no one would ever actually express this publicly, but I think there's a likelihood that police might have decided these raids needed to happen in order to get evidence on the leakers or in order to put frighteners up the leakers. But it seems to me that what's most likely happened is they decided to delay it until after the election. It's not the sort of thing they would have wanted to do, as happened the previous election, wasn't there? There was a raid on Conroy's office in the lead-up to the election. So I think the most likely explanation of the timing is just is waiting till after the election.
I might just add, if I could, yeah. I think if you look at the Arnica leak, you could see somebody close to Malcolm being the source, because the leak's designed to hurt Peter Dutton. Mm. Don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Always think of the political angle on these leaks.
And of course, the leak occurred when the Turnbull government was still in office, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And Peter Dutton was a potential...
Malcolm Turnbull was still Prime Minister. All that was a long way off. So. Yeah.
All right, so we're going here, and then we're going up there, and then we're going back here. Yes.
Is there any validity in the theory or proposition that the politician's explanation that they're not interfering with the administration of the law by the police, in a sense, is hypocritical, because of complainants to the police say, I want you to drop this prosecution and I'm not going to assist you, the police really have no option because they're not going to get anywhere. Isn't that equally open to a politician to say the government will not support any further investigation?
Look, I think actually that is what happens, and I do think in this case the concern of the media companies that journalists will be prosecuted is a little overblown. I mean, I actually don't think Arnica or anybody involved in the ABC 730 report stories will face prosecution. I think the message to the leaker, to Arnica, is a political message, and I think in the other case it's McBride thereafter, and they're looking to see what McBride's footprints are inside the ABC computers.
So McBride is the man who I think is willing to plead guilty,
yep.
But they're after more evidence, right?
Yep.
Chris, do you want to add?
Yeah, I'd add to that as well. I see these raids very much as an attempt to put the frighteners up, the leakers and other leakers. I don't think they're targeted at journalists. I know others in the media, as Chris mentioned, are trying to talk that up. But I think journalists need to be robust and not be scared by a raid like this. It's really directed at the leakers. But the point I was going to make about your question as to whether governments could say call off the leakers, the fact you overlook there perhaps is that so often the leaks will have come from a political office or with some sort of political imprimatur. So governments and ministers are going to be wary about calling off investigations into leaks because people will assume they've called this one off because they know where it came from and vice versa. So I think the rationale inside government, and I've seen some of this from inside government, I've been involved in some controversial leaks. I've been involved in offices where there have been controversial leaks. People just stand back and allow the investigation to occur and hope that it runs into the sand, hope that nobody's been silly enough to out themselves.
There's a question up there, Tim.
Gentlemen, thank you. Tim James. I wanted to seek a comment in relation to Amal Clooney's remarks in the last couple of days. She's said to be a British government envoy in relation to press freedom and has compared press freedom in our country to, remarkably, I think, that of North Korea. Where do you think we sit? I mean, do we have a real issue as compared to other similar countries around the world? And are her comments in any way justified?
I'll go first, if you like, Chris. I'll be broad. You know, I hoped I'd get through this evening without criticising the ABC, but I think this is just hyperventilation. It's what you're going to get from these virtue-signalling leftists, like Amal Clooney. She's feeding off some of the media coverage from Australia, particularly from the ABC, the sort of live tweeting the whole thing, the raid when they had a booking to turn up and go through some files. They turned it into the most dramatic story of the day, 4 days, and I think offshore people who really aren't across all of the facts are just hyperventilating to make political points.
Yeah, I think when you look at the press freedom indexes, you know, we're not at the top, but we're also nowhere near the bottom. I think we tend to be in the high teens or low 20s, so it's not terribly bad. And I wouldn't think people like Putin or Kim Jong-un would be looking to our body politic for inspiration.
Question here, Terry.
If convincing a magistrate
If convincing a magistrate to sign a warrant is not an acceptable judicial process, how do you define that?
Well, I think in the particular case, there was a view that this magistrate simply signed a document that was put in front of him in a small court in Queanbeyan. And I guess what the companies are looking for is a slightly higher test, maybe some advanced knowledge, some ability to contest a warrant, and, you know, a sucker that the person looking at the warrant and the justification for it is indeed a judge, not somebody who normally does...
The magistrate's a judge.
Well, they're not really judges. You know, they normally deal with traffic incidents.
Chapter 3 judges, but they're judges. Yeah. Chapter 3 judges?
Well, anyway, that's the position of the media companies. They'd like a proper judge, yeah. And I sort of think that's... If you're going to... Think about it from the point of view of the AFP. My column, I didn't repeat this tonight, but I said they'd regret this. This was a foolish move politically by the AFP, and they would rue the day that they did these raids. Because they always do. I mean, Chris and I have seen these raids, you know, going on since the 1970s when I started in the business. You know, they would have gone on in the 1950s. It never works, it's always counterproductive, and the police always look like plods for it.
There's a question up the back.
Owen Ether, gentlemen, and thank you for your comprehensive cover. Following Tim's question, are there any national models that we could look to in terms of improvements to the situation that you've just described? Apart from North Korea.
I personally think a lot of issues to do with new media are tricky now. I think Stephen Rothman's judgment in this Facebook issue is very problematic, so that media companies facing stressed business models now have to attempt to moderate comments over which they have no control on Facebook sites controlled by Facebook. I think that's very tricky. I think defamation payouts, we all looked at the defamation law reform in 2004 and thought, the removing of the ability of companies to sue for reputational damage was a positive, and capping of defamation payouts at $250,000 was positive. I mean, if you look at the Rush case, I mean, this will end up costing the Telegraph, with legal costs, probably $5 million.
To the broader impact of your question about national models, I think it's worth looking at Britain, especially when it comes to this consideration of a higher test before there are raids of journalist sources. I haven't had a good look at that in detail, but I believe that they've got a model that Australia is looking at. And when it comes to whistleblower protections, I think the US certainly has some laws that we ought to be looking at. But I urge caution in this. You know, I'm always wary about new laws, you know, and you don't want unintended consequences. So this is where I differ a little bit with the media zeitgeist at the moment. Sure, this is unfortunate. Sure, we should be talking about the reforms. There's crushing pressures on freedom of expression from all sorts of quarters in this country. And these laws regarding confidentiality are only a small part of that. So I wouldn't rush into anything.
Question here,
then
we'll go to Dimitri.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm from the school that believes the ABC in a corporate sense would have to sleep on a corrugated bed to sleep straight. Isn't it rather funny that they come out on this issue, you have people like Flower and that, they're left to themselves and there's no one to defend them. At least, I don't suppose you're part of the Rupert Murdoch conspiracy that seems to inspire the leftists on that, but I mean, I read all the papers and that, and frankly, if it wasn't for Sky and News Limited and that, I wouldn't be getting any truth.
We'll take that as a comment.
So, Dimitri.
Thanks, gentlemen. Perhaps a leading question. Why is this debate being framed as media freedom rather than general freedom? Rather than giving privileges to a certain class of citizens, why not a discussion about whether the laws are fit for purpose and whether the governance of of national security is fit for purpose?
Look, I think that's a really good point. And Chris got onto this at the start of his speech when he talked about the lack of public trust in politicians, in government, in the media. So I think that's a mistake not to frame this as a broader debate. And both of us in our speeches, and we didn't collude on this, but we both ended up referring to other pressures where the media isn't doing enough to encourage freedom of debate. The Israel Folau case, the Andrew Bolt case, we could go on and on. So I agree with you. I think we should be having a debate about freedom of expression, and journalists' rights are only a part of that. And I think Chris and I also seem to be in agreement too that this debate too, focusing on trying to create the impression that journalists are under the threat of prosecution here, is fallacious. I think anybody looking at this situation can see that. While you might disagree and it's dumb and self-harming practice, I think the intent here was to focus on leakers rather than journalists.
A question up here.
Yes, gentlemen. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Gave us a great talk. And you both mentioned about the problem, the leaker inside from the government. But I want to ask a reverse question. And what about outside the government? Say, for example, all those Google, Facebook, all these big media companies, they collect huge data. So I just can't see we have any regulation. They can leak because we have a lot of political scandal in United States, in Australia as well, because those politicians made some comments in this.
You gotta be brief.
Yeah. Yes. So I just wondering, because they collect so many data, not only including ordinary people, but also all these politicians. But are they also, if we don't have a proper regulation, are they also going to create a problem for the government?
Look, I think that's right, and I think it's instructive that people are worried about the AFP looking at journalist metadata, but they're not worried about Facebook and Google looking at people's metadata every single day of their lives. You know, Leon made some comments about Rupert. You know, it seems to me that Rupert's been pretty smart at leading some of the debate about holding Facebook and Google responsible. You know, these people are the biggest media companies in the world now, but they're not treated as media companies. You know, we are held responsible for publishing comments that are on their platform, and we have no access to control. I mean, I think, you know, they've got 90% of the world's advertising revenue, and they're not media companies. Well, if Rupert Murdoch had access to the information and data that Google has, people who hate Rupert would really have a reason to be worried, you know?
I haven't reread Orwell or Aldous Huxley recently, but my memory of their books is they would be astounded today where they thought about government-imposed surveillance and control of our lives, and now that hasn't happened. What's happened here is the reverse. We just offer it all up. We just offer up all this information about ourselves and where we're going, and we seem to be doing it like frogs in a boiling saucepan. It's bizarre.
Thanks, Chris Mitchell. Who better to ask than a former Turnbull staffer? I'm from Tony Abbott's electorate, and I've had a rumour that Nikki Sava was disgruntled with Tony and Peter Credlin because they didn't provide leaks that she expected. Now, I don't have the slightest clue as to what the truth of that statement is. So my question is, what's the story of leaks as a form of political gamesmanship? Is this a frequent sort of thing? Is it used a lot? That's my question to you, to either of you.
Look, I think political journalists live on it, and people like Chris Kenny here, they strategize. You know, they work out who they're going to leak to and what day, and this is our. They sit there on weekends and they say on Monday morning we'll leak them this, and Tuesday. That's how it works. You know, so they can all pretend that, you know, they're not in the business of this, but actually they are in the business of it. No, I think Chris said it, you know, quite clearly. There has to be confidentiality on things that are, you know, of national security importance, but really, most leaks in our country are authorised leaks, and they're run by their ministers.
Yeah, that's spot on. There's so many different levels of this, and some of it can be simply a matter of giving a media organisation the jump on a story. It's less about a leak, although technically it's a leak because you're giving it out there before others get it. But there is a lot of malicious leaking that goes on in politics, and some journalists feed off that. There are a lot of journalists in the national debate now that have a stamp on their head, really. Anyone who reads them and watches closely can see which politicians feed information through which journalists. I don't think you ever want to be that journalist. I think you always want to be a little bit more obscure and have a wide range of sources than that. But there's a bit of that around. And look, and I think a lot of this comes from the worst politicians. I think the best politicians hold their confidences and certainly don't engage willfully in malicious leaks. I think it's usually those who think they're a little bit better than they are and are desperate to therefore harm their enemies who engage in much of that, and that's why so much of it is so destructive.
In all this discussion and what's been going on ever since the raids, it seems to me that it's a trade discussion. It's really about an inside the Beltway group of people who've got an enormous amount of noise, and they can make a lot of noise, and they're really just talking about themselves. The ordinary Australian voter really doesn't give a hoot. But there is a problem between information that is real national security risk, and there has been an ongoing discussion in recent times about even archival information that you can't get your hands on at the National Archives because it's still held back by the security groups. So is there a way in which we can break through this notion of what is really the national security information that really needs to be protected for all sorts of reasons, and freeing up maybe a little bit more the information that isn't going to do anyone a great deal of harm?
That's a really good point, and I think we've both referred to this problem with the over-classification of information. You quoted Brett Walker, and I mentioned Jim Molan and Dennis Richardson. These are all people you know have great experience and would have a lot of faith and commitment to national secrets and national security, but they all say, too much stuff is overclassified. When you think about the way the public sector works, or really the private bureaucracies as well, it's not surprising. It's the butt-covering exercise. If in doubt, classify at the highest level you can. So I think government's got to really work hard at that. But the thing you've got to keep in mind is, as Dennis reminded me, I rang him the other day to make sure I wasn't misquoting him on this stuff, and he just reminded me just how limited top secret classified information is. Now, I worked in foreign affairs, so we saw quite a bit of it, but most political officers don't see much top secret classified stuff. It's defence, it's foreign affairs, it's prime ministers, and even the staff who see that would be quite limited. So I think it's an important part of the debate, but it skewers it a little bit. I think most of the day-to-day confidentiality issues are run-of-the-mill proposals for policy changes and the like that go through cabinet. And as Chris says, quite often politicians run them through cabinet so they can get that cabinet protection.
So just the Dennis you're talking about is Dennis Richardson, former head of ASIO and defence, etc. Okay. Now, I think it was the final question. Michael Byrne.
You've focused heavily on security. The reality is some of the most, if you like, spectacular leaks of, say, of the budget, 81, where financial information which would have had market impact and could have benefited some people was leaked to Laurie Oakes and regarded as a brilliant journalistic triumph. No one has ever been prosecuted, no serious attempt to do anything about that leak, although I must say it hasn't happened since. Do you approach financial security with the same enthusiasm as you do security in the defence sense?
We might get final comments first with Chris and then from Chris Mitchell.
All right, thank you. Thanks, Michael. And that's an interesting point. I mean, we've all known about that leak of Laurie Oakes. I think it was 1980 or the early 80s. It was one of the greatest leaks that any journalist has ever had. And I've always thought about it in that context. But when you great story, get the budget the day ahead of everybody else, brilliant. But what was the national interest? What was the public interest? You've got to question what the public interest is in that. They're going to find out everything in that document the next day. So that's where the debate gets a bit messy. I do think financial security is important. That's why I raised that when I mentioned the case of Godwin Gretsch. These accurate leaks that he'd given to the opposition for some time before his forged leak related to the government's response to the global financial crisis. This was critical for Australia and for our economic security. So the big questions about what Gretsch did there, I'm astounded that he's portrayed as some victim now. Now, he's one leak where we saw the police track him down and turn up at his house, but he was never prosecuted. Yeah, I'll explain that one to me. I don't get it. But yeah, I think these are fascinating questions, and that's why I just say leaks. Look, Chris has dealt with so much of this at a high level as an editor-in-chief, right? And this is my point about the fragmentation of the media. If there's a leak that goes to an organisation full of serious journalists and they've got an editorial leader like Chris Mitchell, then they'll question, you know, what needs to go into the public arena, when, what do we need to hold back, what's the public interest, how do we treat this thing responsibly? That's been the protection we've had in the system in years gone by. But now it's just dumped out on WikiLeaks or dumped out by Snowden. It's a whole different ball game, and it creates real dilemmas for us.
Chris Mitchell?
I'll take your point about Laurie and the budget, and it happened to John Hewson too. Remember, Fightback got leaked the day early, came out of the printer. I do think in financial matters, actually, we should expect more openness. So I think what's happened in my lifetime, company CEOs really don't talk to journalists anymore. Everything is done through corporate spin doctors. Mm. I think you had a better financial flow of information and better understanding about what was happening in the markets when trusted journos could just pick up the phone to the CEO. And that's probably the same in politics, actually. You know, probably in your day, you know, more journos spoke to ministers than they do now. On the specifics of the budget, I'd have to say it drove me mad that the budget was still a lock-up. Mm. I mean, the budget was so deliberately and concoctedly leaked for weeks and weeks and weeks beforehand. It cost us millions of dollars every year to go down there to put up staff in hotels and to be locked up till 7:30. And I think the whole thing is just an instrument of manipulation of the media. So we're in there so that endless Treasury boffins can tell us that black is white. And I just think in the end, when I think, you know, Labor had a little period of trying to just release the budget at 2:30 in the afternoon, and it sort of backfired, and I think maybe the minister walked into a cupboard and, you know, he got fired. And but look, I just think they should. I don't think there's anything secret in budgets anymore, and I don't think it moves markets. And I think usually most people like Chris Kenny could tell you a fortnight out from what's already been leaked what the deficit number's going to be and what the growth rate's going to be.
That's because it's in May instead of in August. Which
well, that's probably right, yeah.
We could go on, but it's right on the hour, and we always stop on time. So, look, it's been a terrific discussion tonight. Chris Kenny, who's worked at very high levels of government, but also a practicing journalist, and Chris Mitchell, who's worked at very high levels of the media and has been in contact with so many politicians and staffers over so many years. So, look, it was a great discussion. Our speakers had different perspectives on the same topic, and that's why I think we got a great coverage of all the events. We could go on all night, but we don't go on all night to say many thanks, Chris Kenny. And many thanks, Mr. Mitchell, and we'll hope to have you back again. I know you've got a book in the process, and have you got another book coming up?
Oh, I should do, but not yet.
There will be one. We'll see you back. Thank you very much.